ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The rise of artificial intelligence and what it will mean across almost every aspect of our lives has been discussed and debated for years. But now it's here, and its influence is huge. It's also big business, with trillions of dollars being invested in the sector. But how does it affect the flow of information that we get locally? How does it affect news that regional Australians rely on? Staff at one of the largest regional newspaper groups say the use of AI is causing them serious concern.
Journalists who are MIA members are bound by the MEAA code of ethics and you know, expected to uphold that in order to uphold community trust.
And the iconic film The Dish celebrates 25 years.
Let me get this straight. You've lost Apollo 11.
Yeah.
Southern Hemisphere's prime receiving station has no idea where Apollo 11 is.
Yeah, it's on its way to the moon.
I'm Alex Barwick, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Aranda Country in Mbantua, Alice Springs. We head to the northernmost point of the Australian mainland first this evening. One of Australia's most historically significant native titles is among land covering almost a million hectares of Cape York that has been handed back to traditional owners. The claim covers an area near where Captain James Cook first made landfall in 1770 and is among three to be finally settled by the federal court this week. Reporter Connor Byrne has the story.
Traditional performers usher in a new era for the Wootuti traditional owners as they now hold title to their homelands, known as the Captain Billy Landing Area on Princess Charlotte Bay. They join the Gugu Yimitir and Yitawara traditional owner groups, who received their own determinations from Chief Justice Deborah Mortimer. The handback is significant to the Gugu Yimitir, who feel they were directly affected by the prolonged landfall on their land of British explorer Captain James Cook and his crew from the Endeavour, who stopped in Cooktown for repairs for 48 days in 1770. Wootuti traditional owner and Cape York Land Council acting CEO Richie Amat says that moment cannot be understated.
When he broke down in the Endeavour River, he talked to the traditional owners there, the Gugu Yimitir and the Yitawara people. Yet his report back to England was to say, nobody lives here. So that's why colonisation started.
Yitawara traditional owner and native title claimant Des Rumble says violence and displacement followed, which included massacres during the Palmer River Gold Rush of 1873.
And we had heaps of people coming in, and suddenly gold fever had struck. Then the Aboriginal people started to feel threatened because their sacred business was being interfered with. The land that they hunted on, that they lived on, was being interfered with. And then when the governments of the day brought out legislation which said, under Aboriginal Protection Acts, that we're going to now remove these Aboriginal inhabitants to these missions, places like Palm Island and Yarrabah and Cherbourg, they were all sent off there for really no good reason except to clear the country. So the relationship was very much soured.
But threats to country have been more recent too. Wootuti traditional owner Jason Chippendale remembers his people fighting against sand mining on his land in the 1960s. He paid tribute to traditional owners from the recent past as well as the distant past, who fought to keep land in their name.
If you have that connection, you'll feel it. Country need people, people need country. When you're on somebody else's country, you don't feel yourself, but when you're back on country, all your pain, all your worry go away.
The determinations give the traditional owners clarity on what can happen on their land, but they assure that native title will only improve outcomes for all. Gugu Yimitir traditional owner Ricky Lee Woibo says the future of the land would start now.
I think future generations, the land I'm hoping that will create future economic development, future empowerment, whether it's within tourism, whether it ranges, women, men, kids. I'm hoping that today really looks to the future and what the land can actually bring for our future generations.
And neighbouring traditional owners are also optimistic about the future. Cape York Land Council Principal Legal Officer Michelle Chaffee says that by the end of next year, all of the current claims under the Cape York No. 1 file with the federal court will be settled after they were lodged in 2014.
And we know that there are only two key groups left, and that is the Eastern Gugu-Yalanji and Western Yalanji groups. That's that area around Daintree River and sort of inland, still in the southeast region, that are yet to be determined. But we're very confident that we're on track to see those determinations occur by mid-next year, and then those smaller parts will be determined as we progress through the second half of the year.
And as Richie Amat says, that will pave the way for all Cape York traditional owners to work together as equals on their land.
Our people now have an opportunity to create economic development, home ownership, build new communities. We can get into the carbon industry. All of that is up for grabs now, and hopefully these determinations by the federal court will give us that opportunity.
Connor Byrne with that story. Artificial intelligence is now part of our everyday lives. Most workplaces are navigating how it can be used. The big tech firms like Google, Meta and Microsoft have launched AI tools and products like ChatGPT dominating the space. It has a huge influence over the flow of information, and that includes news and newsrooms in regional Australia. Staff at Australian Community Media, ACM, the owner of papers including the Canberra Times, the Daily Advertiser in Wagga Wagga and the Newcastle Herald, amongst many more across the regions, say the rollout of generative artificial intelligence to assist their journalism has become problematic. Staff say AI has misattributed quotes, wrongly identified people within headlines, and provided misleading legal advice. Reporter Emil Pavlich has the story. Emil, thanks for speaking to Australia Wide.
Good evening, Alex.
Emil, how has Australian Community Media, ACM, been using AI?
So as you said off the top there, staff at ACM, one of the largest owners of a range of regional papers, say the rollout of their generative artificial intelligence model to assist their journalism has been quite problematic. So staff say that AI has misattributed quotes, wrongly identified people within headlines, and provided misleading media law advice. I should say, though, all the stories that the ABC heard about, the journalists picked up on the mistakes before publication. So the ABC's found no real evidence of these factual errors made by the technology having ever been published. But in a leaked email to staff on October the 3rd, seen by the ABC, ACM management said AI experiments and testing were happening in its newsrooms in three ways in particular. So this includes story editing and coaching, headline writing, and to come up with story ideas. But the ABC also understands the rollout of the technology is being used in some cases to analyse a news story's legal risk, which is quite a common thing for journalists to have to do before publishing their work. It's also understood that this generative AI model being used is Google Gemini and has been adapted for the news company so that ACM data on the platform will not be shared with Google.
And so the people you've spoken to, have they expressed frustrations to you? What have they said?
Yeah, they have. So a former Australian Community Media ACM journalist, who we'll call Tim to protect his employment prospects, says the internal AI model has produced some headlines for news articles, which we heard about, and actually one of the headlines that he encountered contained false information by mixing up certain people within a story, and therefore it actually opened this journalist up to possibly being sued. Luckily, this mistake was identified by him and it didn't go to print, but he said it made him feel really frustrated and a little bit anxious, wondering what else could have possibly been published in print that had gone unchecked by him.
And what has the union had to say about this?
So I also spoke to the Journalists Union, which is called MEA, stands for Media Entertainment Arts Alliance, about what they're hearing on the ground from journalists. Obviously, you know, they have organisers that, that speak to journalists, and they really highlighted that the issue of generative AI is a huge issue, and probably the issue that they get asked about by far the most out of any issues. So specifically within ACM's practices, or what they're hearing from members within ACM, is that there have been directives at some newspapers to use Gemini in all aspects of reporting. And the union says that in those instances, Gemini is actually making things up, misattributing some pretty important facts like charges in court, and generally, I guess, is looking to replace the sort of ethical practice that journalists go through. So I spoke to union organiser and director of the media section of MEA.
Communities, local communities, rely on their local paper to inform them about what's going on in the courts, and there is a real public interest in that. So there's a big impact on the community if that information is wrong. And further to that, journalists who are MEA members are bound by the MEAA Code of Ethics and you know, expected to uphold that in order to uphold community trust.
So that was Cassie Derrick, who is the media director of MEA, which is the union representing journalists.
Emile, why did this group of people decide they wanted to speak out about what's been going on?
I guess many ACM employees spoke out because they were quite concerned, I guess, just generally about how these kind of AI models would be used within journalism and kind of what it means more broadly for the industry. So another ACM employee whose name has also been changed to Sam, to protect his identity, feared that the technology could be used as a justification for job cuts. And I should also just mention that ACM, you know, cut 35 editorial jobs last year, which was a consequence of Facebook's parent company Meta withdrawing funds for regional journalism as part of the news media bargaining code. So Sam, the ACM journalist, said that the workforce was really already stretched, and he said at the moment they're not really using AI a lot, very lightly, he said, and he doesn't think it's having a really big impact on their journalism. But he did say, with the caveat, that there is the fear that, you know, if they're going to become more stretched and more reliant on things like AI, that potential for errors really could be a factor.
And what has Australian Community Media, ACM, had to say in response to these concerns around the use of AI?
So obviously, yeah, we went to ACM about some of these concerns that we'd heard from you know, staff members within the organisation. They said pretty clearly that they do not use Gemini to write stories or rely on it for legal advice. They also said that humans make every decision on words that they publish. The ACM spokesperson said that, you know, very cautiously, very carefully, and very openly, they are exploring tools that can better help them serve the communities. They really, really adamantly said that AI is not replacing journalists, editors, or lawyers, and that integrity and accuracy are not negotiable. In response to what we heard from the MEA organizer there, the union rep, they think ACM said that it was not appropriate to air anonymous claims before even speaking to them. So I guess that saying that, you know, really it's the union's prerogative if they want to share stories about what they're hearing from members rather than actually address them with ACM. ACM finished by saying that they're going to continue to listen to their teams and provide information and training about how to responsibly use this technology.
Now, we know that there is widespread use of AI in various ways across many media organisations. Only recently, the ABC has launched an internal generative AI called ABC Assist. What has the ABC had to say about the introduction of AI into its newsrooms?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, ABC Assist has launched. It's a kind of a tool for ABC journalists to search for archival information within the ABC, summarise old ABC content, and also sort of draft interview questions, among a few other features. But an editorial guidance note on ABC's editorial policies website says that in the news division, all uses of the AI technology and the tool in production of audience-facing content, so stuff that is going to be seen by the public, must be referred to an editorial manager. So pretty strong language there about the way it needs to be referred to editors if it's going to be ever used for stuff that the public will see.
Emil, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Reporter Emil Pavlich with that story. You're listening to Australia Wide. My name's Alex Barwick.
You're listening to Australia Wide.
To Bridgetown in southwest WA now, almost 3 hours' drive from Perth. A confronting road safety program is showing southwest teenagers the brutal reality of regional road trauma by staging a simulated fatal crash and giving a tour of a local morgue. The annual program, called Mystery Tour of Life, is a joint effort between emergency services and the high school in the regional community of Bridgetown. Reporter Anna Cox has this story.
That's the voice of Bridgetown Senior Constable Mike Smith, and the banging you can hear is the door to a holding chamber in the morgue at their local hospital.
Go through to the morgue. Mate, if you go in there and you decide you don't want to be in there, you can walk out. There's no pressure.
The people he's talking to are the Year 10s from Bridgetown High School who are about to get their L plates, and this is a part of their local road safety program.
It's the 22nd year, I believe, that we've presented this. It's my 11th year. So the Mystery Tour of Life is to educate Year 10 students into road rules, how to drive carefully on the road, and the pitfalls of driving dangerously on the road. The day starts off with videos that show them what happens if you don't wear a seatbelt. We then move on to a scenario. We found showing quite graphic but equally factual videos is a good way to get the kids' attention. It's a good teaching tool.
This is the Year 10s on a bus en route to the crash scenario, which is simulated with more than 20 people, emergency services and actors all volunteering their time.
Leave all of that stuff in your bag on the bus, please.
And this is the sound of the crash simulation.
Well, we've got to put that to the side.
There's a yellow car and a grey car sitting mangled on a Bridgetown street. Actors from the local theatre group are the drivers and passengers. They're covered in fake blood. Police are littered around the site. The ambulance and fire brigade arrive, and then the jaws of life come out.
Then ambos have.
One actor lays stationary on the road.
We need to keep going. Everyone feels it has a massive impact.
And a white sheet is placed over her.
It's not been exaggerated in any way, shape or form, so it gives them a true understanding of what goes on.
The kids get back onto the bus and they're taken to the local hospital, where the confronting simulation continues and they're spoken to by a local nurse.
We don't know who's coming in. My son, could be my mum, my best mate.
Another scenario is acted out in an emergency room operating theatre. And another warning, this audio is graphic. After 20 minutes in the operating theatre, students are taken to the viewing window where people view their deceased loved ones.
Depending on how bad the accident is determines how much of that person they can see. Sometimes they can be so disfigured as a result of the accident, that's what they'll see. They'll just see a body underneath a sheet.
Patrick Butterley is a local funeral director. They've been a part of the program for the last 6 years, and he takes the reins now.
I think it is really beneficial. I have four young children myself, well, they're all drivers now, and I just feel that with what we see in our industry, and, you know, you see the injuries and the impact that is on the family afterwards.
A roller door rises. There's a hearse and two caskets behind it. A larger brown one and a small white one designed for a baby. A familiar sight for one southwest father who spoke to the cohort. He lost his 19-year-old son in a motorcycle accident 2.5 years ago.
3 weeks, he was pronounced brain damaged. There was no hope. So they sat us in a room and said, there's no Institute is always full of. It was my son, my mate.
Joe Reap is one of the Year 10s present.
My biggest fear would probably be other people on the road and just other reckless drivers. It was quite graphic, but some of the stories were, but I think better than sugarcoating it, really.
And so is Alex Maguire.
Well, the speeches from the parents, they stood out a lot. It was quite confronting at the hospital, showing what actually happens after accidents, the bits that you don't see.
Bridgetown High School student Alex Maguire ending that report from Anna Cox.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
We head to parks in regional New South Wales now. It's the movie that immortalised the critical role of Parkes Radio Telescope Observatory in the first moon landing. And 25 years on from its release, it continues to have a cultural impact. After The Dish came out in cinemas, tourists flooded to the CSIRO Murrayang facility north of Parkes, introducing its critical role to a new generation of Australians about the research that's carried out there. The ABC's Hamish Cole has this report.
Let me get this straight. You've lost Apollo 11.
Yeah.
Southern Hemisphere's prime receiving station has no idea where Apollo 11 is.
Yeah, it's on its way to the moon.
The Dish created a lasting legacy of Australia's critical role in the first moon landing way back in 1969. Using a bit of creative license to tell the story of how the Parkes Observatory beamed back images of Neil Armstrong walking on the moon to 600 million people.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Featuring the likes of three-time Golden Globe winning actor Sam Neill, it was a raging success when it was released in October 2000. For Roy Billing, who played the role of Mayor Bob McIntyre in the film, it was one of his favourites.
And it's such an important event in people's lives and in the, you know, the lives of the world. It sort of brought people together, I think, that day. They told me the story, which I'd never heard before, about the Dish and the moon landing, and said they wanted me to play the Mayor of Parkes and gave me a script to take home. And I read it and I thought, oh, wow, this is great. There's no way I was going to turn that down.
The movie was the brainchild of Rob Sitch, Jane Kennedy, Tom Gleisner and Santo Chilaro from Working Dog Productions and came out a few years after another Aussie classic, The Castle. Rob Sitch said in a statement that he had never heard of Australia's involvement in the moon landing and didn't believe Tom Gleisner until they researched some old newspapers. Parkes Observatory operations scientist John Sarkisian was an advisor on the film and says it wasn't unusual when the movie was released for people to be unaware of the connection to the moon landing.
During the Apollo 11 mission, Australians were very well aware of the observatory's role in the mission because it was publicised everywhere. Everyone in Australia knew about it. It was the front page of every newspaper. It led every news bulletin on television, on radio and so on. So it was very well aware. But in the intervening 30-some years or so, people forgot about that, you know. And so the film was able to reintroduce the CSIRO a role in that mission to, as I said, a new generation of Australians.
The Dish had an immediate impact on the number of people travelling out to visit the telescope.
Prior to the film opening, we had about 50,000 people visit the telescope every year, which is pretty good. But the year after the film opened, the numbers jumped to 120,000. And we thought it might start coming down the year following, but it kept going up and up and up. Reached about 138,000 in 2003. That's when we then built the cafe so to cater for the increasing number of visitors. And today the numbers have stabilised to around 100,000 visitors to the observatory every year.
And there is often one scene in particular people are keen to hear about.
We're a professional unit,
Mitch. You right?
Sorry, mate. Still not flat enough, Glenn.
I'll give it a tweak.
I'm going to drop it down a couple of clicks, probably on NASA settings.
The most common question we get asked now at the observatory by visitors, did you really play cricket on the Dish? Did they really play cricket? And the answer to that is no, unfortunately.
It also had a huge impact on the town of Parkes. Ken Keith was in Year 9 when the moon landing occurred, and then Deputy Mayor when the movie was released.
We were all watching this little black and white TV, 300 that were in the school.
And I was so proud to say that I came from Parkes and that the moon landing was coming from the Parkes radio telescope at the time. And then to see the movie recreate that wonderful feeling of the Parkes community about seeing Parkes recognised on a worldwide scale for what they've had. And it was just a wonderful thing for Parkes, the movie The Dish.
While a telescope named Mariang is more commonly known for its role in tracking lunar missions, its main aim is to assist with research into astronomy. John Sarkisian explains.
Our role here is to do radio astronomy, to study the radio missions from the stars. That's what we do here. And that research would involve things like, for example, mapping the gas clouds in our Milky Way galaxy. In fact, a few years ago, we discovered a new spiral arm to our Milky Way galaxy from observations that we conducted here. We study pulsars, the very dense, compact remains of really massive stars that have exploded. And this telescope has been responsible for finding more pulsars than all the other radio telescopes in the world combined. And that allows us to study matter in extreme states, in states that we can't reproduce here on the Earth, so that we have a better understanding how matter behaves under extreme pressure and temperature and gravitational fields and so on. And for that reason, you know, the work that we do within CSIRO is really quite amazing. And it's great that the film The Dish has allowed us to say that, to bring that information, that knowledge to the world.
Continuing a space legacy that has lasted decades and brought about a classic Aussie film.
I mean, no offence, but when you think about it, the Americans spend 10 years, billions of dollars to let us watch man walk on the moon, and in the end it falls to you blokes. I mean, how do you feel about that?
A lot better before you open your trap.
Hamish Cole with that report on the 25th anniversary of the film The Dish. And finally to Noosa on the Queensland coast, where locals are on high alert, sometimes even hiding for fear of attack. Yes, it's springtime, and that means magpie swooping season. In the holiday hotspot of Noosa, a seriously cranky crow has been getting in on the action and is making its presence felt, with tourists and locals being forced to duck for cover. Reporter Jessica Ross has tried to understand the unusual behaviour of these highly intelligent birds.
In Alfred Hitchcock's 1963 horror classic, The Birds, a murder of crows lives up to its name.
Do not make a sound until I tell you to run. Then run as quickly as you can.
In this Queensland case, it's just the bird, singular. And while it's not a killer, it's still inflicting a bit of terror along Noosa's famed Hastings Street.
It actually started swooping me, and I thought it was the dog, but it was actually swooping my head. And then people were yelling and saying, quick, quick, it's coming again, run. And there were quite a few people doing that because they could see it was attacking me.
Julie Perry managed to escape the cantankerous crow without injury.
By the time I got in the car, I had to sit and actually compose myself because it was,
Fellow long-time resident Linda Harvey wasn't so lucky.
It swooped up from behind me and really hit my head a couple of times with its claws, gave me a massive headache. I didn't have any blood or anything, but it's a really hard thump on the head.
Both women were walking their dogs when the dive bombing took place.
Number 10, which has an outdoor cafe area, I had to hide under their canopy, and the crow was sitting up on the roof of number 10, looking down at me.
My gosh.
Waiting for me to come out. And fortunately, a couple of the waiters from number 10 came out and had a water bottle and sprayed at it until it flew away. But it is quite aggressive. It just chases you.
Michelle Duggan works at a hat store on the famous Noosa shopping strip.
Crow flies out of the tree there and then attacks the dogs walking along, even dogs that are in the car. I've seen it actually fly down to a car and try and have a go there. Can't say I've known a crow to do it. I've certainly been attacked by a magpie myself.
So the usual swooping offenders are indeed, you know, the masked lapwings and the magpie. So it is a little bit more unusual for it to be a crow, but not completely unheard of.
Dr. Christina Zdenek from the conservation charity BirdLife Australia has a likely explanation Right now, it's crow breeding season.
They're very likely to be protecting their nest, so either eggs or young inside the nest at that very vulnerable time.
9 years ago, when another crow was on the warpath on the Gold Coast, experts suggested it could be copying magpies.
Being highly intelligent birds, I would not put it past them to learn a behaviour from even another species, but there's really no way for us to directly test that.
Noosa Council has installed temporary signage to alert visitors and is also warning that it is illegal to harm native animals and it's best to avoid the area where possible.
You can wear a hat, glasses to protect your eyes and just give them some wiggle room and understand they're doing it tough. They're just trying to eke out a living in amongst this human altered environment that we've created. It will pass and then they'll be back to being normally behaving crows.
Until, of course, the sequel next spring. Reporter Jessica Ross there.
And that's Australia Wide for this week. My name's Alex Barwick. A huge thanks to the program's producer, Alex Hyman, and thanks for your company. Have a lovely weekend.
ABC Listen.